Evening. I believe we have a quorum, so I'll call the meeting to order at 6:01 p.m. Welcome to tonight's meeting of the Northern Regional Advisory Committee Council. My name is John Cabot, and I'm the chair for the Northern RAC, and I represent the non-consumptive from Hooper, Utah. We'll go ahead and start tonight with introductions, and we'll start over here.
My name is Craig Van Tassel. I'm from Camas, and I'm a sportsman representative.
John Blazard from Camas, representing agriculture.
Kevin McLeod, public at large, West Haven.
John Wall, Riverdale, public at large.
Matt Clark, Ogden, at large.
Mike Lauder, sportsman's rep, Hooper.
Justin Oliver, West Haven, at large.
Russ Lawrence from Ogden, public at large.
Chad Jensen, Paradise, elected.
Kristen Purdy, Ogden, non-consumptive.
Bryce Thurgood, Perry, at large.
And Justin Doling, I'm the regional supervisor, and I serve as the executive secretary, and I'm a non-voting member.
Okay, I'd like to also recognize Byron Bateman, who's joining us tonight, and he's our representative for the Wildlife Board. For those of you that are attending the meeting tonight, I'd like for you to take your cell phones out and put them on silent so we can have an undisturbed meeting for this evening. Tonight's meeting is the Regional Advisory Council, and the purpose is to gather public input concerning wildlife management policy rules and regulations. The council will then make recommendations to the Wildlife Board, and the Wildlife Board then considers those recommendations from the five regional advisory councils and sets policies for all protected species in the state of Utah. The meeting will be recorded tonight for transcription purposes, and the audio recording and minutes of the meeting will be available on the DWR website. With that in mind, when you're speaking, either asking questions or making comments regarding the presentation tonight, we ask that you use the microphone and that you state your name before proceeding. If we go ahead and take a look at the agenda for tonight's meeting, if there is no objection, we will approve the agenda for tonight's meeting. There being no objection, the agenda for tonight's meeting is approved. The next business in order is the approval of the minutes from the previous meeting. And I believe everyone should have received a copy of the minutes via email. Are there any corrections to the minutes? Okay. Seeing none, then the minutes are approved as circulated. And we'll go ahead and move on to the next order in business, and that's the Wildlife Board update. And Bryce, Bryce will present the wildlife update.
Okay. There was the first motion was on the Bucks Bulls once in a lifetime recommendations. They had a motion to move that we approve the split, the difference between the division's numbers and the Southeast Regional Advisory Council's recommendations, and increase the number of permits on the Manti from to 275 instead of 550. And that motion passed 4-2. The next motion was to that they accepted the division, the regional advisory council's proposed permit split on the Pine Valley and Zions. And this one got changed later, but it was 54% legal weapon, 23 archery, 23 muzzleloader, and it failed, 2 in favor, 4 opposed. And then the next motion was, there was a motion, well, first of all, there was a motion made to increase the youth archery or youth rifle tags by 300 tags from 5 to 800, like our division or our rec recommended, and it failed 2 in favor, 4 against, and then it passed to leave it as it was, 4-3. So, and then the division, they made a motion that they stay with the 2015 elk numbers on the Wasatch and leave the permit totals at 760 instead of the increase, and that motion passed unanimously. Then it was made a motion to accept the division's, the remainder of the division's recommendations as presented, and that passed unanimously. And then,
I guess it was after the fact
that they came back in and they had a, because it was a technical issue that they had, but they moved, they amended the previous approved permit on the Pine Valley and Zion. Instead of 54-23-23, it had to be 56-22-22, just for technical issues, and that passed. The antlerless permit recommendations passed unanimously. The 2016 CWMU antlerless permit recommendations passed unanimously as presented. Then the 2016 CWMU variance requests that were presented, they passed 4-1, with one person being absent that had to leave. And then they adopt or move, they accept the hunter education rule as presented, and that passed unanimously.
Okay, thank you, Bryce. Are there any questions on the Wildlife Board meeting? Okay, seeing as there's none, then we'll move on to the regional update.
Well, welcome everyone to our meeting tonight. I just want to give a little bit of an update on what's going on with the Division of Wildlife. So some highlights from each one of our sections. Clint Brunson, who used to be our, he was our walk-in access biologist. Then he moved over into our wildlife recreation program. And now he promoted into the aquatic habitat restoration biologist position there in the Ogden office. So Clint will be dealing with a lot of river restoration work that's occurring here in the region. The aquatic section is also trying to develop an internal brood stock for Arctic grayling, and it looks like they've kind of zeroed in on Smith and Morehouse as that area where they would collect brood that would go into the hatchery and provide Arctic grayling for some of our stocking efforts. They're also working with Pacific Corp. Pacific Corp is going through their relicensing agreement on the Weber River, and they're looking at trying to accommodate fish passage, primarily upstream, but also they have some turbines that draw water and generate electricity, and there's hopes that they can make those more fish friendly in order to pass fish and not have mortality. So they were actually up testing that on the river last week, and the results were a little bit mixed. Some of the larger fish did not pass successfully, but some of the smaller fish, 6 inches and less, did pass successfully through the turbines. So they'll continue to look at that. And they wanted to report that the high elevation lakes right now are fishing really well, so get up into the Uintas and take advantage of some of that cool temperature and catch some of those fish up there. And then the other kind of hot spot that's a secret here in the region is the Bear River right now is fishing well for catfish just below Cutler Dam. So a couple little tidbits there. In our wildlife section, the biologists are in the process of conducting rabbit route counts where they drive a specific route and then count the number of rabbits that that they see along the way. It gives us an index to monitor rabbit populations throughout the region. And then some of our depredation issues right now, and they're fairly localized, but due to drying conditions, have have become a little problematic for landowners. So we've been working with landowners in Cache Valley and also over in the Bear Lake area to try to alleviate some of the depredation that's occurring to the fields. We're also working with a rancher out in West Box Elder County. And the wildlife section has also been out trying to collar a female bear to look at reproduction and recruitment. And they were successful last Friday collaring a female that actually had two cubs with her, and they got a collar on her, so we'll be able to look at the survival of those cubs over the course of this coming winter. They're also still working on elk unit management plans. That effort is still underway. And then we have a project that was approved to place GPS collars on 120 elk in the greater Hardware Ranch area to look at where elk are coming from and where elk are going to as they come in and interact with each other on the feed row. So we'll be collaring elk at Hardware, and then we'll be doing some collaring over at Deseret, north end of Cache Valley, and then some animals in Idaho and also Wyoming. And so that'll be a 2 to 3 year monitoring effort to see where those animals are moving and whether or not they're coming in contact with animals that may already have brucellosis. So that's kind of exciting. And there'll be GPS collars, so it'll be real-time live data that we can look at. Our Utah Hunt Planner, which is a new kind of a new link in our website, should be up and running shortly. This is an area where you can go in and when it's up and it's live, you can go ahead and click on it, and then you can zoom into the area you have an interest in hunting. You can look at ownership. There's some ownership layers. There's unit boundaries. There's a little drop-down menu that gives you some of the highlights of the unit as far as what the biologists are seeing, what elevation the animals are at, just some tips about hunting, and we're hoping that will actually provide a better information to the public than we're currently providing. So look for that. It should be up and running here shortly. In our outreach section, they assisted with the National Youth Hunter Education Challenge, and that was held in Pennsylvania this year. They're also getting ready for the state fair, and there's plans to publish a new community fishery brochure, and that should be published here shortly. In our habitat section, we had a project out at Willard Bay where we constructed a rock reef. We used a barge and loaded dump trucks onto the barge, moved the barge out into the bay, and then dumped these rocks to form an artificial reef. And that project took about 2.5 weeks. It was it had numerous partners: Rocky Mountain Anglers, Parks and Recreation, Blue Ribbon Council. The Habitat Council provided funding for that. Restoration Fish, the Fish Habitat Partnership provided some funding as well. And it was about $120,000 project and created about, 50 loads and probably 300 linear feet of new fish structure at the bottom of what is normally a pretty flat bottom reservoir. So we're excited about that one. In our Great Salt Lake program, Randy Berger retired in mid-July. We're in the process of trying to refill his position. And then the WMAs will be treating Phragmites throughout the month of August into September. They're also looking for help. So if anybody wants to get out and experience Phragmites control work, you're more than welcome to contact John Luft or Chad Cranny. And then the Great Salt Lake program also banded 500 young pelicans on Gunnison Island, which is kind of I say island, but it's really not an island anymore. It's a peninsula off the mainland, but they were able to go out to Gunnison Island and successfully banded about 500 pelicans in 3 hours. And then from law enforcement, Josie Byers is our new conservation officer in West Box Elder County, and she'll be starting here soon on her field training exercises with existing conservation officers. So that's all I had, unless there's questions.
Any questions for Justin? All right, thank you, Justin. I'd like to take a minute and go over our standard operating procedures for tonight. It's been probably 3 months since we've all been here, and I'm sure there's people that haven't attended Iraq before. But the meeting will proceed as follows. A representative from the Division of Wildlife will make a presentation on the agenda item, and then we will have questions from the public. We will then move to the council, and questions will be taken from the council. That is the time for questions only. Following questions from the council, then we will move to a comment period. And we'll start with the public can ask or can raise comments or concerns regarding the agenda item. And individuals who are representing themselves will have 3 minutes to do so. Individuals representing an organized group will have 5 minutes. In either case, whether you're a group or an individual, we ask that you fill in a blue comment card, which is located on the back table there, and that will help in transcribing the minutes and keeping a record of the meeting. Following the public comment, then we will move to the council, who will make comments and then vote or make motions regarding that particular agenda item. I would like to remind the council that members who wish to abstain from voting should state their conflict, and council members voting in opposition are also asked to provide their reasoning for that. We will then follow the motion to the next agenda item until we've completed the agenda for the evening. Okay, with that, we'll go ahead and start with our first agenda item for the evening, and that is Fur Bearer Rule Amendments R657-11, presented by Leslie McFarland.
I apologize, you get a full RAC meeting with mostly me, so. Okay, so the first thing that I have for you tonight is the Fur Bearer Rule. This rule, most of the changes that were made to the rule that were included in your packet, most of them are clerical or just housekeeping changes. There were a few that did affect some rule changes, and so I'll just present the rule changes here. The rest of it, where it's just housekeeping, I won't go into all of that. So under our definition section, under bait means any lure containing animal parts larger than 1 cubic inch. In the previous rule, it also defined, or it also had a section in there about 8 cubic inches of bait. We took that out and just left it anything larger than 1 cubic inch. The 8 cubic inch was inside of cubby sets and things like that, and we just didn't feel in meeting with law enforcement and things that we really need to define a size inside of a cubby set. A cage trap means any enclosure containing a one-way door triggered by a treadle or pan that prevents the escape of an animal after the door closes. Cage trap was previously not defined in the rule, so we've put that in there. In the rule before, every time it talked about a foothold trap, it went into all of the types of a foothold trap. So under definitions, we've just put the definition of a foothold trap, which means any underspring jump trap or long spring trap or coil spring trap with two smooth arms. Or jaws that come together when an animal steps on a pan in the center of the trap. Rather than having that stated over and over again in the rule, we'll just say foothold trap. Good condition just means that a carcass is fresh or frozen and securely wrapped to prevent decomposition, so the tissue remains suitable for analysis. And owner, before in the rule, every time it talked about the owner of a trap, it gave a really long definition. And so we've just defined the owner to mean the person who has been issued a trap registration number associated with one or more trapping devices. We are requesting, and you'll see why in the Bobcat presentation, but we are requesting to have the last day that a Bobcat or a Martin can be permanently tagged as the second Friday in March. Right now it's the first Friday in March. We're extending that by a week. Under Martin, previously it required that anyone that harvested a Martin had to turn the jaw into us. We are not currently doing anything with those jaws. We're not doing age analysis or anything like that. So we've taken the requirement to bring a jaw in. We still do want the intact carcass when we tag those. We've added two things to the section about a person may not disturb or remove any trapping device. We've added the landowner where a trap has been placed. In particular, if the landowner didn't give permission, they can go unset the traps. Or the owner of a domestic pet that has been caught. They can remove their animal from the trap. One other thing that, in consultation with our law enforcement section, that we have added is the ability to use protected wildlife. Before, you were not allowed to use like a roadkill carcass or anything out there. You can place a trap near a carcass of protected wildlife, provided the carcass is not moved or relocated for the purpose of trapping wildlife, and the trap is not located within 30 feet of that carcass, and that's to prevent raptors from getting into traps and things like that. And that's what I have on the fur bearer rule. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, Leslie. We have one comment card regarding we're at questions. Are there any questions from the public regarding the presentation? Council? Questions? Okay, now comments. There's one comment card from Chris Carling.
Yes, I'm Chris Carling, representing Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife. Thank you for allowing us to be here. And simply, we'd like to express our support for these rule amendments as presented. Thank you.
Thanks.
I have a comment card from Stan Bassett, but I don't know if it's for this agenda item or the one regarding the rule or the number 7, the harvest recommendations. Okay, would you like to comment now, or?
They're going to be separate chunks.
Yeah.
I'm Stan Bassett. I'm representing the Utah Trappers Association, and we support the recommendations that has been presented.
Okay. Thank you. Anyone else wish to comment? Okay, we'll move to the RAC then for comments and or motions. Motions?
I'll make the motion that we accept as presented.
Okay.
I'll second.
And second it. So the it is moved and seconded that the council approve the presentation as made. Are there any questions or discussion on the agenda item, on the motion? Okay, seeing none, then we'll move to the vote. All in favor, signify by raising your hand and saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? It's unanimous. Okay, next, Leslie, is the Bobcat Management Plan.
Okay, just a little bit of history on the Bobcat Management Plan. The Bobcat Management Plan is not required by rule or law. It's something that the division put in place to kind of protect the species, to give us some guidance for biological data collection and to help us so that we can better manage our populations. The plan was originally approved for 2007 to 2016. It was prepared by a Bobcat working group, which contained representatives from the Division of Wildlife Resources, the Utah Trappers Association, the Utah Houndsmen Association. There was a RAC member that was on this group, as well as some academia and some non-consumptive representatives. Rather than put an expiration date on the plan, what we're going to put on this plan going forward is that it just will be reviewed every 10 years through an internal division review or as needed if some things are not working correctly. This current revision that I'm presenting tonight underwent an internal review with our wildlife section, our law enforcement section, and then we also consulted with the Trappers Association and the Houndsmen Association. The purpose of the Utah Bobcat Plan is to direct the management of bobcats to assure the future of the species through protection and propagation and management, while considering bobcat distribution and the intrinsic scientific, educational, and recreational values for the citizens of Utah. Our goal is to maintain a healthy bobcat population within existing suitable habitat and provide quality recreational opportunities for bobcat harvest while considering the social aspects of bobcat harvest. So our population objective within the plan is to maintain the current statewide distribution with a reasonable proportion of older age animals. And that's the reason why we collect the lower jaws to get tooth ages. So there were four performance targets in the previous plan, and I'll go over these really quickly. What we look for in our bobcat harvest are the proportion of kittens or yearlings in the harvest. We looked at historical ranges when they put this plan together, which fall within the proportions on the right-hand side. So we want to see the proportion of kittens or yearlings in the harvest about 49%. Our adult survival, we want it to be about 68%. And our percent females in the harvest, we want it to be between 41 to 45. If it's higher, so if you've got higher kittens and yearlings in the harvest, that indicates a positive for population growth. If our adult survival is also higher than 65 to 72, then that indicates a positive for population growth. And if our percent females in the harvest go above 45, that's a negative for population growth. So that's kind of how those work. There was a fourth variable that was put into this, and it was set days per bobcat. That's largely based on survey data from trappers. The problem with that data is it's not biological. It's based on experience. It's based on all different kinds of things, and it really doesn't indicate how the population's doing. It only indicates how your trappers are doing at trapping bobcats. So we did remove that from one of the considerations. So our strategies for managing bobcats, we want to maintain a baseline management if two or more of those variables on the previous page are within or outside the historical range in a positive direction for population growth. And the baseline management strategy is to allow 6 permits per individual, and the season would run the third Wednesday in November. And here's one of the changes. We're lengthening the trapping season to go to March 1st. Previously, it ended much earlier. But we are going to request to move it to March 1st and no cap on the permits. So the way that we would now use those performance targets, if two or more of those performance targets are outside the historical range in a negative direction for population growth, then we would decrease the number of bobcat permits available per individual by 1 to 2 permits. And we would keep doing that as long as those metrics were out of line. If they start to return to positive directions, we would keep it the same for the next year, and then we'd start to slowly increase that back up towards baseline. So that we're not keeping it too low, but we can allow for increases if things start to return to normal. We would do the same thing with season length. We would decrease the length of the bobcat harvest season on the front end by 1 to 2 weeks if two or more of those variables are outside historical ranges in a negative direction for population growth. And we would do the same thing. We would keep the season length consistent with the previous year if those values continue to be in the same direction. If they start to decrease, then we would continually decrease the season length. If they start to return back to normal, then we'd slowly work back up toward baseline. If all three of the performance targets are outside the historical range in a negative direction for population growth, then we could cap the number of permits at 80% of the number of permits sold the previous year. They'd be on a first-come, first-served basis, and this would be implemented in addition to decreasing the permits and decreasing the season length. After a cap would have been implemented, we could begin to increase the season length and the number of permits available per individual by 1 to 2 weeks or 1 to 2 permits per year toward baseline if the performance targets are moving back toward historical ranges in a positive direction for population growth. We're putting this in because of a concern from a couple years ago. So we were at a cap on our bobcat tags. Things went back in a positive direction, and rather than incrementally adding weeks or tags back in, it jumped all the way back to baseline, and there was concern that we would be affecting the bobcat population by jumping all the way back to baseline. So we've put this stepwise process in. And there's some outreach and education parts to the plan, and I'm not going to go through all of those because there are a lot. But basically, our first objective is to increase awareness and appreciation of the general public for the role of bobcats in our Utah ecosystems. And that's developing educational programs, looking at the role of predator and prey interactions, and providing educational opportunities on the use and role of trapping and hounds. Objective two is to maintain quality hunting and trapping opportunities for bobcat. We want to work to promote ethical and legal hunting and trapping practices through our fur harvester education program. We've been working a lot with the Trappers Association and Houndsmen Association to provide incentive programs for them to report things that they see are being done wrong. What else? We are working to hold annual coordination meetings with our wildlife section, our law enforcement section, and the Trapper and Houndsman Associations to keep communications open. And then objective three is to reduce conflicts between those involved in bobcat harvest and other recreationists. We really want to promote the setting of traps and snares away from popular hiking and recreation sites, and promoting that these should not parallel established hiking trails. We want to encourage houndsmen and trappers to avoid trapping or pursuing bobcats in highly urbanized or populated areas or popular recreation areas to avoid capture or conflicts with domestic pets. And then the last one there is to avoid using lethal sets when trapping in areas where it is likely they could catch a domestic pet. And then we do have some strategies to try and work with recreationists to respect trapping and the use of hounds for pursuit of bobcats. We do have a research objective, and those that we have identified are to look at population estimation, survival techniques, population connectivity throughout the state, and identification of sources and sinks. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Leslie. Are there questions regarding the presentation from the public?
Robert Burns, Centerville, Utah. Leslie, did you say what the proposed term is at 10 years again?
Yeah, what we're going to do is not put an expiration date on this plan and just have a review every 10 years.
Okay, so it's... and then it's kind of a strange management plan as far as a lot I've worked with, that sections are attributed to certain people.
Yeah, that... So without having to reform an entire new committee... I wanted to keep the purpose and the structure of the plan the way that it was, because overall the plan worked well for bobcats. There were just a few things that needed to be updated, so we did not reform another committee and rewrite the whole thing.
You didn't think it would work if you pulled those people's names out of, or those, some of those sections too personal of a statement for...
A little bit. Some of them weren't really okay. Division statements. They were that person's statements, and so I didn't want to rewrite those sections.
So where you edited those sections, do those people agree with your edit?
The one section was written by our biometrician, and she edited her own section. The others, I just took out things like that referred to bobcats eating a pet chihuahua and stuff like that.
Okay. And then you don't think you need to replace Kevin with you as far as since you're the program?
No, because I didn't write those sections. Kevin wrote those.
All right. Thank
but
you.
My name is on the front of the plan.
Yeah. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Any other questions? Okay, move to the council. Are there questions for the Bobcat Management Plan? Okay. Comments from the public. Mr. Burns. You have 3 minutes.
Robert Burns again. I think the plans worked really good, especially the change that you made shortly after we started it. So I would recommend to the council that you recommend the Wildlife Board approve it. It does have a strange layout, but you're working with what you have. Maybe in the future you could just change it to a division document and present it that way. I think it would be a lot cleaner, but thank you.
Okay, thank you. I have no other cards regarding this agenda item. Would you like to comment?
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, I'm Chris Carling with SFW. I put 4 agenda items on 1 blue card. That may have been a mistake.
Oh, I see.
I apologize.
Gotcha.
Again, we, SFW, would just like to express our support for this plan and also recognize the Utah Trappers Association and the Utah Houndsmen for the work and volunteerism that they put toward it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Any others?
Yep. I have a card, but I just need to...
I'll pencil you back in.
I'm Stan Bassett from the representing the Utah Trappers Association, and the Utah Trappers Association supports the new recommendations.
Thank you. Anyone else? All right, council for comments and or motions. John.
It's good to see a deal go through where we don't have a lot of negatives, everybody, so that must mean it's working for everyone.
Would you care to make a motion?
Yeah, I'd make a motion that we accept the division's changes okay. As presented.
Okay, so John makes the motion and then Craig seconds. Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, I'll call the question. All those in favor of the motion to accept the division's presentation the rule amendment as presented, signify by raising your hand and saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, it's unanimous. Okay, next agenda item, Leslie. Number 7, Fur Bearer and Bobcat Harvest recommendations for 2016-2017.
Okay, so now that we did those first two, I can go to this one. So just a little bit of information on our Bobcat Harvest this past year. There were 9,447 tags sold. That is down from the 13,000 the previous year. Part of that, we think, is due to the increase in tag price the fee increase that we implemented the year before. Also, Bobcat pelt price did start to decline, and so I think there were fewer people that were participating. There were 2,338 bobcats that were harvested this past year. Total trap harvest was 1,683. Hunter harvest was 140. And we had 2,338 trappers versus 2,578 the previous year. And our number of hunters also declined that were pursuing bobcats. It went from 388 to 305. So just a little bit to show you some of the age data on our bobcats. You can see that the axis on the side is the proportion of harvest. And then the bottom axis there is our age in years. And you can see that we have a large number of bobcats that are in the yearling class, which is one of the targets that we look at, is to see how many are yearlings. That does indicate population growth for us. So again, from our plan, our performance targets to adjust our permit numbers, we look at our percent young, and the target range we want to see there is 42 to 56. We look at our percent adult survival. We want that to be between 65 and 72%. And we look at our percent females in the harvest. We want that to be between 41 and 45. This past year, so this third column over, our percent juveniles in the harvest were at 62. That is above our target range of 42 to 56. So that is a positive for population growth. Our percent survival estimate is at 73%, so that's also outside of our historic range, and it's a positive indicator for population growth. Our percent female is within the range. Our range is 41 to 45, and they're at 44%. So based on that, again, if two or more of the targets are within or outside of the range, then we maintain our baseline, which is 6 tags per individual. The season from the third Wednesday in November to March 1st with no cap, and so that is our recommendation. The season would run from November 16th to March 1st, and again, no cap. And then for our other fur-bearing species, we just need to set our season dates. So beaver and mink, and these are all consistent with previous years. Our beaver and mink season, we're requesting from September 24th to April 5th. Badger, gray fox, kit fox, ringtail, spotted skunk, weasel, and marten. We're lengthening those seasons to match that for bobcat, so we don't have any conflicts with seasons closing down early and to prevent issues with law enforcement trying to figure out what somebody's trying to catch or catching a species for which the season is closed. Thank you.
Okie doke. Thanks, Leslie. Questions from the public? Questions from the RAC?
Yeah, John.
How do you determine the survival rate?
So we do it based on the ages that we get from our tooth and then from our survey data, and it's a, and Justin can probably help me because I'm not good at this, but it is based on model data. It's a project, is it? Do you remember how we?
It's essentially you create a life table that allows you to look at survival.
So it's a scientific.
Yeah, so
looking
you.
Looking at papers to.
Yeah, based on the age of the harvest, you can generate a life table and it'll give you a survival estimate.
So it's kind of like what we do for bears, but in a little bit different way. So you build the population back, and that's how it tells you.
So it's kind of like an educated guess?
No, it's not. It's not that at all. I mean, it is based on what we collect, and so it is based on what hunters provide us.
It's based on the harvest collection.
Yeah, there's no other. With all of our predators, unfortunately, there's no other way to get at populations because we can't fly them like you do deer or elk or things like that. So we have to use the metrics that we get from hunter harvest in order to estimate populations and survival and all of that.
John Wall.
At what age is bobcats, male and female, considered adult, and is it due to their when they can breed?
Yeah, it's based on reproductive status, and it's 2 years old. Two.
Craig?
Yeah, I was wondering about those other species. Do you have management plans in place for the other species?
No. No, and on those other species, what we do basically is monitor harvest through survey.
Kevin?
You say that there's no cap on permits, but it's limited to only 6 permits per person.
Right.
For the year,
right. So if there were a cap, then we would say 80% of the tags that were sold the previous year. So we sold 9,000. Last year, so 80% of that would be available, and you could get up to 6 tags, but once it hits that 80% of the 9,000, then we wouldn't sell anymore. It would shut off.
Okay, question in my mind was, are they bought in lots of 6 and only 6 at a time?
You can buy anywhere from 1 to 6, okay. Unless you went to a certain Walmart and they made you buy 6. But you could buy anywhere from 1 to 6.
Well, they're looking for the profit.
I don't know what they were doing.
Thanks, Leslie.
Uh-huh.
Hey, Leslie, do we know how many kit fox are, approximately off the top of your head?
How many what?
How many kit fox are taken every year?
I could get you that information, but I didn't bring any of the harvest stuff for that with me.
And then do these individuals, do they report non-target wildlife as well?
Yeah, on the survey they do.
That's good. That's great. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Okay, any other questions for Leslie? All right, we'll go to comments from the public, and we have Chris Carling.
Thank you again. Chris Carling, representing Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife, and SFW once again supports the DWR's recommendation for fur bear and bobcat plan for 2016 and 17. Thank you.
Good. Thanks. Stan Bass.
Stan Bassett, representing the Utah Trappers Association, and we support the recommendations as they're presented.
Any others for that agenda item? Okay, moving to the council, comments and or motion.
I'll make a motion to accept the recommendations of the division.
Okay. We have a second.
Aye.
Okay. Seconded by John Lazard. Okay. The motion is to accept the recommendations presented by the division. Are there any questions or comments regarding the motion? Okay. Seeing none, we'll go ahead and call the question. So all those in favor signify by raising your hand and saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? It's unanimous. All right. Next agenda item is the last one for Leslie. Cougar recommendations and rule amendments for 2016 and 17.
Okay, you're almost done with me. Okay. So we'll just take a look really quick at our historical hunter harvest. Cougar harvest in Utah has been managed under limited entry hunting since 1999. Back in the mid-90s, you can see, so let me explain the graph first. So the axis on this side are the number of cougars that are taken, and then that's by year on the bottom axis. The green line are the number total sport harvest, and then the colors are different here. Then the yellow line below that are the total males in the harvest, and then the orange line below that are the total females split out of that total harvest. So you can see males to females. And what we don't want to see are the females equaling the males in our harvest. So that's kind of what we're monitoring for when we look at males to females. Since 2000, we've averaged about 321 limited entry or split permits, and we have an average of about 254 quota. This past season, we offered 495 permits. 246 of those were limited entry or split, and 249 of those were quota. Our total sport harvest was 371, with 45% of the permits filled during the limited entry season, and then the remaining 68% of the permits were filled during the harvest objective season. Total harvest, including wildlife services, nuisance, roadkill, and those types of things, was 394, compared with 372 last year. So again, we do look at the proportion of males to females in our harvest, and you can see since about 2009, what we don't want to see, and this is in accordance with our plan, is we don't really want to see, if we're managing for cougars, we don't want to see female harvest above 40%. And so you can see since about 2009, we've maintained below that 40% threshold. And so the light gray is actually our male harvest, and then the dark gray is our female. This year, statewide, our female, including young of the year female, our total female take was 30%. So it was way below that 40% threshold on a statewide basis. And that includes all of our predator management units, too. In our management plan, we had a performance target that we want to see the age in our harvest. We want to see animals that are equal or greater than 5 years old, and we want that to be about 15% to 20% of our harvest. You can see that this last year, 40% of our harvest, the animals were equal or over 5 years old. So we've got a really healthy adult population. The other thing that we also track is livestock depredation. The green line on top are the number of incidents. The orangish line on bottom is the number of cougars that are removed by wildlife services. This past year, the number of incidents of livestock depredation related to cougar almost doubled. It went from 34 to 60. So some of our increases that you'll see tonight are in relation to some of those livestock things to try and see if we can get that livestock depredation back down. So our recommendations, and I didn't make Randy come up unless he really wants to. our recommendations are set up by region, and I'll just explain the table really quick. The left column is the unit. The second column over is whether or not that unit is under predator management and what it's under predator management for. So if it's yellow and it says deer or bighorn sheep, it's under for both species. If it just says one species, it's just for that. And then the next column over are the number of permits or quota that were offered last year. The next column over are the percent females in the harvest. Again, this is based on a three-year average. It's not just 1 year. It's three-year average. Same with the age data. So looking at the number of animals that are at least five or older in the population based over 3 years. And then the next column over, that's what the regions are recommending this year. If it's green, it's an increase from last year. If it's blue, it's a decrease from last year. And then hardly any of the regions recommended any change to strategy for this year. So there aren't any changes that way. So increases for the northern region, the Box Elder Desert, they're increasing by one. The cache, they would like to increase by two. The Chalk Creek Camas, they would like to increase by two. East Canyon, they're requesting an increase of two. East Canyon Davis is under predator management for another reason, and that's to prevent animals from coming down into Bountiful in Davis County. And so they keep that harvest there pretty high. Morgan South Ridge, they're recommending a decrease of two, and the Ogden unit, a decrease of one. Northeastern region, they are not recommending any changes to any of their units except for the Wasatch Mountains Current Creek. They're recommending an increase of two, largely because their age structure and their female harvest is very low. Central region, they do have several units they are increasing this year. I won't go through all of those unless anybody has a specific question. Some of these units are associated with those livestock depredation things, and they are also under for predator management. Southern region, they're recommending a decrease on the beaver units, the Fillmore Pavant, an increase of one, and then on the Zion unit, they're recommending a decrease of two. Our southeastern region, they are recommending a boundary change and a split on the San Juan unit. So there is a thing here too. The white there indicates a change in hunt type. So they're carving out a section of that unit for bighorn sheep management, and they're recommending that it go to an unlimited harvest. So just to kind of show you how permits have been structured the past 3 years, what we're recommending this year is 223 limited entry or split permits, and our harvest objective quota totals we're recommending about 299. So a slight decrease in our limited entry and a slight increase in our harvest objective. There is one boundary change recommendation. This is on the Box Elder Pilot Mountain. This is to make the boundary consistent with bighorn sheep and elk, and also to honor our MOU with the state of Nevada, that if you have a cougar permit, you can hunt on the Nevada side of that boundary, but if you hunt on the Nevada side, you have to make sure that you obey all laws and rules in Nevada. The second boundary change, again, is on the San Juan unit in the southeastern region. They're splitting that unit into two sections. They'll have the San Juan Desert, which is largely desert bighorn. It's a largely bighorn sheep unit. There's very few deer there, and so they're recommending that go to an unlimited harvest, which we can only use that type of strategy on bighorn sheep units where there are no deer populations. And then the San Juan Mountains, they're leaving that the same as what the San Juan used to be. Our season dates that we're recommending for this year are consistent with previous years. So November 9th to May 31st for limited entry. Our split season limited entry portion would go November 9th to February 24th. And then it would transition to harvest objective March 2nd through May 31st. Our harvest objective season would run November 9th through November 4th. Our unlimited quota would be November 9th through November 8th. That's open year-round. And our pursuit season would run November 9th through May 31st. So So in summary, our recommendations are in accordance with our cougar management plan. All females were considered in our harvest. Our age performance target is an extra measure on population. And increases in certain units should help address some of our livestock depredation concerns. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Leslie. Questions from the public? Questions from the RAC?
I had a comment. Should I wait?
Do you want to wait to the comment section?
Yeah,
or do you want to have
it?
Okay. Any questions? Okay, we'll move to comments from the public, and I have a card from Ben Blanquist.
I appreciate this opportunity. My name is Ben Blomquist. I'm from Morgan. Primarily hunt the East Canyon, the Morgan South Ridge units. Spent a lot of time in that area. Me and the guys I hunt with tend to take the majority of the lines out of that East Canyon unit. We feel that increasing that unit by two tags, which would be doubling the tag numbers in the last 2 years, is really going to affect the population in that area. We've tried really hard to only take toms in that area. We've got a high tom kill rate due to the access that we have to the area. It's very accessible. We can hunt almost the entire unit. There's roads in just about every drainage. I would just ask that you reconsider leaving the tag numbers alone, and I think it'd be beneficial to the population. Any questions?
Great. Thank you.
Thanks.
Appreciate it. Okay, Mr. Burns from Centerville.
Robert Burns. Leslie, the boundary for the San Juan changes wasn't available online, so I'm guessing from looking at it's close to what the San Juan sheep unit is, but a little bit different.
Yeah, I'm not familiar enough with both the sheep unit and it to know if they're exactly the same.
Okay.
And the reason it wasn't in this is the region sent it last minute.
Can you put that online so we could look at it if we want to?
Okay. I can ask Stacy to update it.
Thank you. And I would recommend that you approve what the division's presented. I think it's following the plan, and we're doing a pretty good job, except for our depredation is back up again. So higher tags hopefully will address that. Thank you.
Thank you. Chris Carling.
Chris Carling, SFW, and Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife, again, supports the cougar recommendations and rule amendments for 2016 as presented by the division, with one exception, and that is on the Southwest Manti unit. We are asking that maybe you consider increasing the recommendation on permit numbers from 5 to 8 and go to a split season on the Southwest unit, and here's why. We've got a lot of very dedicated members down that way who are lifelong residents and hunters of that particular area, and they see, as the division knows well, the decline in the deer populations, and the entire Manti unit is in predator management, is under objective for deer, which qualifies it for predator management, and 8 on the Southwest unit would be a modest increase from the 5, which is recommended, and would really help, we feel, the struggling deer populations there. That's our recommendation. And additionally, we would like to acknowledge the sound science, the thoroughness, and the professionalism with which the division has conducted its research and preparation in these recommendations. We do appreciate it, and we recognize it, and thank you for it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Stan, did you have anything? Okay. All right. So that's all the comments I have from the public. Oh, could you fill out a comment card when you finish? Okay. All right. Go ahead.
I'm Randy Hatch. I represent the Utah Hound Association, and we support the current proposals.
All right. Thank you. Any others? Okay, we'll move to the council.
comments. Yeah, great.
Leslie, would you comment on the two proposals, one from the East Canyon and also the Manti?
I'd like to have the region come up to talk about East Canyon since that's their recommendation first. Just because
the population is down. Randy Wood, Wildlife Manager, Northern Region. We're just following the plan to the T. We want to manage one of the targets is less than 40% females in the harvest. 3-year average is at 23, and greater than five years old or greater, we want 15 to 20% as a target, and we're at 33, again, well above it. So we're just going with the plan.
To add to that, I'm just curious, as they mentioned before during his comments, that they've targeted mainly males. Is there any kind of mechanism, in the process to try to maybe allow for that? Because it sounds to me like those numbers could be skewed as far as the total number of lines off the unit compared to females.
I'd turn that to Leslie if there is a way. I would assume that most harvesters, and this is an assumption, probably tend to go towards the larger if you can. So I don't know if that carries true across. But
well, what we kind of look at, there's nothing, I mean, where these guys are the primary harvesters in that unit, if it's a private line, I mean, it's largely locked up. And so they, of course, are controlling the harvest. So there's not a lot we can do about that. But it does allow us to increase if the numbers indicate that the population is doing okay to provide more opportunity. I mean, it's within the plan to do that. So
they've got to kill more females in order to.
Well, I mean, that's part of the mechanism to keep the population from growing too much is to harvest females. And so that's why we look at that. Okay, and then the Southwest Manti, that's a central region unit. It's the fourth one down. They had 5 permits. The percent female is at 28%, and the percents that are 5 years and older is at 31. So there's not a lot of female harvest. The animals are older. The plan does indicate we can increase. That biologist chose to be conservative and did not recommend an increase. So it can increase, but they chose not to.
So that particular unit has an older population of lions, is that what you're saying?
It's not so much an overpopulation, older. Yeah, I thought you meant over.
No.
I'm like, no. That's not what I say.
So what is the implication for removing more older males from a population like that? In terms of
I mean, when you start removing older males, you can influence some of the other things in the unit. You can allow younger males to take up smaller territories and encourage more cougars in an area if you take out too many older males. That is in the research that way. The reason that unit is, I mean, the whole Manti is under objective, and this year when we looked at population growth, the models for deer indicated that it was stable and not really increasing. And so the purpose behind it would be to just try and help as one of the factors to increase lion tags.
So potentially increasing the number of tags in that unit could result in taking more older males that have larger territories and are keeping some of the smaller males out, could increase depredation.
Yeah, usually what happens, though, is they take the older males first, then they work on younger males, and then they go to females. So that's why we monitor the female harvest, because it kind of tells you how many males are available when they start going for females. Does that make sense?
Yep. Thank you. John.
It seems to me that if we say, well, because the deer population is low, it's got to be the lion's problem. It seems to me like there could be habitat issues, other things, other than just saying we need to harvest more lions because we don't have the deer population.
So that's probably one thing I need to clarify. That's not what that says in the Cougar Management Plan.
Right, I mean, but that's the request.
Yeah, that's not what the plan says. The plan says that as one piece of the pie, we can implement predator management to try and help improve mule deer populations. But we recognize that predator control by itself is not going to increase deer populations.
John? Oh, I'm sorry. I thought John Blizer, you had another comment.
I was just going to make a motion if there's another comment.
I've got two questions, just our two comments. I don't know if in the future, as they discuss the plans, if it's a possibility to include landowners in particular areas. I don't know if that's already taken place as you're
the region together. Yeah, the regions are supposed to meet with their landowners, their respective people within their unit, to discuss them before they're turned in.
And then my last comment was just you mentioned something about road mortality with lions. I'd like to thank you for your part in managing the mountain lion population.
Yeah, my car wasn't so
bad. And I'm curious what kind of damage they do to a vehicle.
It totaled it.
I'm just curious.
It was a 6-year-old, by the way.
Was it a little car?
Was it a male or female?
Male. 6-year-old okay. Male.
Okay. Any other comments? Then we're ready for a motion. John, you want to make one?
Based on the information, you have one more comment?
Yeah, I just have one more comment. Sorry. This is kind of tough. You know, I leaned over to Justin. You know, SFW wants to increase in an area to help deer herds, and these gentlemen here want to decrease, you know, in regards to opportunity and stuff. I think we've accepted this plan. The management plan was presented and accepted in its entirety. And so I'd just like to, you know, make everybody aware that we've already accepted a plan, and if it falls within the guidelines of the plan, then I think we have to stick to the plan. That's just my two cents.
Thank you.
That's why I would like to make the motion that we, based on the information that we've received, that we accept the plan as presented with no changes.
Okay.
I'll second that.
And seconded by John Tassel. Or John Wall, sorry. Okay, so we have a motion and a second. And are there any discussion on the motion? Okay, seeing none, we'll call the question. The motion on the table is to approve the Cougar recommendations and rule amendments as presented by the division. All in favor, signify by raising your hand and saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? No opposed. So the motion passes unanimously. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Leslie. Item 9 on the agenda is the proposed fee schedule, and this will be presented by Phil Gray.
Thank you, Dr. Cabot. As mentioned, I am not Kenny Johnson. My name is Phil Gray. I'm the business analyst with the Utah Division of Wildlife, and we'll be presenting the proposed fee changes. So what we're going to talk about tonight, what we're going to introduce to you is a few different ideas that we've been kicking around. There's three categories of changes. There's some reductions, two small increases in means of housekeeping, and some other changes to help address some the costs of some programs within the division. So first, just to remind everybody the process for which fees go through. It's a little bit different than our other recommendations for permits and such. So the fees will go through the rack and board process, just like they're doing now. Once that's done, they're taken to the governor's office and reviewed, and then recommended to a legislator. We have to find a sponsor that's willing to introduce these. It's introduced in the Natural Resources Appropriations Subcommittee, They then review it, approve it, deny it. They can take pieces of it. They can change pretty much anything that they want. They can reject it outright. If approved, it then goes into the overall annual appropriations bill for natural resources and then is voted on by the entire legislature. Once approved, the fees take effect at the beginning of the next fiscal year. So if these fees make it all the way through the process, they will be in place beginning July 1st of 2017. So as you're all aware, we're primarily funded by sportsmen through hunting and fishing license sales. So when we go about fee changes, we do so very carefully. We look at this stuff and we analyze the data just like our biologists analyze all of the data they have. We have years and years worth of license sales data and information. We talk to other states, see what they're doing, try and make ourselves competitive and marketable among the other Western wildlife states. So we do need to sometimes make strategic changes in order to recruit and retain and reactivate hunters and anglers. And so for 2017, we're proposing a few minor changes that will make a minuscule amount of revenue, but they will make a huge impact in the long run. The first thing that we want to talk about and we want to propose is a reduce in fee for a general season turkey tag for resident youth. We have seen numbers of youth purchasing general season permits becoming somewhat stagnant. It's not really falling off yet, but it is kind of catching our attention. So we want to reduce that fee from $35 to $25 for a resident youth permit for anybody that's 17 or under. And we're expecting this to cost us about $20,000 a year. But we think it is well worth it in order to get more youth out there hunting turkey in the spring and the fall. The next thing we need to do is there was an oversight when we brought out our bucks and bulls fee changes several years ago. There was one that was missed. So we have a multi-season limited entry and premium limited entry for buck deer. We also have that for bull elk. We established a separate fee for the single season bull elk and a separate fee for the multi-season bull elk. And we neglected to do that for buck deer. So right now, if you draw a limited entry buck deer tag, it's the same fee as the guy that draws a multi-season limited entry buck deer tag that gets to hunt all three seasons. So we need to acknowledge the increase in value of that tag. So we're suggesting that the premium multi-season buck will go from $168 to $305 for a resident. For a non-resident, it'll be $568 to $1,025. The resident limited entry, so just the not the premium unit, just the limited entry unit, will go from $80 to $145, and a non-resident will go from $468 to $845. And we're guessing this will bring us about $3,000 in revenue. So again, we're not trying to make money, we're just trying to acknowledge the value of that multi-season tag and price it accordingly. The next thing we're suggesting actually came out of the elk working group that developed the statewide elk management plan. Was the suggestion to investigate a multi-season, general season bull elk tag. So the idea is that you would be able to pay one fee and then hunt the archery, muzzleloader, and rifle on a general season elk. We don't know what this idea is going to look like yet. We don't even know if the wildlife section is going to implement this hunt. But we want to have the fee available and ready to us just in case it is something that comes up that they want to do. We don't have to wait an entire year and a half to go through the legislature and come back around to the next hunting season in order to implement this. So the idea would be resident elk multi-season for general season would be $150. Non-resident elk, it'd be $700. So that would just be the regular fee now tripled. The other thing we want to do is decrease antlerless elk mitigation tags. So these are the vouchers that we give out to landowners, not the free permits. Those will still remain free. But the vouchers that we give out to them that they can give out to anybody, we want to decrease that from $50 to $30, take some of the burden off the landowners in trying to get some of these problem elk addressed. Overall, we anticipate this will bring in about an additional $90,000 in revenue, just projecting some rough estimates on the number of people purchasing those multi-season elk permits if implemented. Finally, we have a number of outdoor recreation programs the division sponsors and puts on, and what we're asking for simply is the ability to create a floating admission schedule, basically, that would allow us to charge an appropriate fee that would recover the cost of some of these events. Additionally, we are asking for a range for the RV camping fee. Right now, the only WMA that's capable of doing this, the only one that we foresee ever being able to do this, is Lee K Center. There is sewer and electrical hookups there. So we want to be able to set a fee seasonally. We wouldn't be changing it every weekend. It would be set and posted for a season, but to be able to make it to where we're not losing money on that. We anticipate that having these, in addition to recovering costs, well, we're anticipating it will generate about $11,500 in revenue, but again, that is just to offset the costs of some of these programs and services that we're providing. So again, in summary, they're minor fees and adjustments. Hopefully, the big one is to recruit and retain youth in turkey hunting. Offer this new multi-season permit if the wildlife section decides to go that way, and recover some costs of some public programs that we've been sponsoring. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Phil. Do we have any questions from the public? Questions from the RAC? Yeah, Kevin.
When you looked at the youth turkey, you say that you figure it'll cost the division about $20,000. Did you figure in what you feel the increase in numbers would be in that, or did you just take the number of tags that were sold last year and?
We looked at the number of tags over several years and the trend that it's following, and if it remained at that trend, that's what we would lose.
So if you increase the number of tags sold,
that was worst case scenario.
Not worst case scenario.
Worst case is we don't recruit anymore, which we're hoping is not going to happen. And this is just one prong of what we're planning to do with youth turkey. We don't feel that this is the only barrier. We feel this is a barrier, so we're going to address everything. There's going to be some outreach programs going on. The outreach section has actually done a great job over the last few years of really promoting turkey hunting, and our turkey numbers are through the roof. We're selling a lot of turkey tags. People are getting out there and having a lot of fun doing it, but we're not getting the youth that we were hoping to get. So they're going to refocus those efforts, try and retain more youth, or get more youth activated. But this, we're hoping, will help that it's not such a sting to dad's pocketbook, mom and dad's pocketbook, when they go to buy 5 or 6 turkey tags in the spring.
Okay. Just, I'm curious if there's been comments. I just can't see that lowering $10 is worth losing 20 grand. I mean, the box of bullets, I don't know. I guess if you add everything together, it could get expensive, but I just feel like $35 is a pretty reasonable price for a turkey tag, and I'd have a hard, I don't know if it's worth to lose the money. I don't believe that you're going to get any more tags sold. I'm just curious if you had comments about people saying they're too much or anything, any complaints?
Just the opposite, actually. The biggest complaint is it's too much for youth.
Really?
And funny enough, the average age for youth turkey hunters, as near as I could tell, is 16 to 17 years old. So most of them will be paying that fee for 2 years before they start shelfing out the $35 again.
Okay. Chris.
Do we have any history of previous fee reductions, particularly for youth, and if they inspired more youth to get out in the field and hunt?
Actually, yes. Just a few years ago, we did a huge fee change for combination and small game hunting licenses as well as fishing licenses, and we restructured it and created several new age breaks for youth, both for fishing and for hunting. So it used to be anybody under 14 had a fee. Anybody over 14 was an adult, and we changed that and set it to up to 14. For a hunting license is $11, 14 to 17, can't remember for a hunting, but for a combination license it's $20 and $38 for anybody over that. So once we saw that happen, we saw a huge influx of youth purchasing the general hunting license. So it was, especially in that 14 to 17 year old group. So yes.
Any other questions?
I have a question about the Calop mitigation tags and your proposal to drop that fee from $50. Has that been a complaint by the landowners?
I can't say that it's specifically by the landowners, but it has been mentioned. For a number of years now, we've had the antlerless elk control tag. Mm-hmm. So we offer these tags, an unlimited number of tags, if you have a qualifying buck, bull, or once-in-a-lifetime tag, and a qualifying area. And these qualifying areas are ones that are over-objective, experiencing a lot of depredation problems, and the such. So we would give a landowner a stack of vouchers and say, here you go, you can give these out, let people come hunt your property. But then they try and give them out, and somebody would say, why would I take that $50 voucher from you when I can go get a $30 antlerless control permit? So we're just trying to make those two permits equitable.
Because, I mean, my experience has been that most of these people that sell the vouchers will give you the voucher, but then charge a $300, $1,000 trespass fee. So I'm not seeing how dropping that $15 is going to increase the sales of them if the landowners are charging $500 or $600 just to get access to the land.
That's absolutely something that's been going on. It's been going on a long time, but we simply can't control what landowners do for access on their property. It's something the division has struggled with for a long time. We need to continue working with landowners. If they really want problem elk taken care of, we need to provide access.
So with the new tags that are going to be implemented this coming year, I believe, is this the same? Is that fee, or what are the landowner vouchers? Or
right now they're $50, and they'll remain that until 2017, July 1st, before any of these changes.
Those are the tags that we just recently approved to do the change in the elk management, as far as to allow more increased hunting on private grounds compared to public. Or
are you talking about the private lands only antlerless elk tags?
Yes.
Yeah. Those are out there. They've been on sale for about a week and a half now, and they are.
And what are the price on those?
Excuse me.
Those are $50, or what are the price?
$50 for resident. I'd have to look up non-resident. I want to say. I don't want to say for sure. I can't remember.
Any other questions? Okay, we'll move to the public for comment. I don't have any cards, but if anyone would like to make a comment, we'll take your card afterwards. Okay, move to the RAC for comment and or motions. Yeah, Kevin.
Just a comment, and it's probably not the right time again, but I'm going to mention it again. I'd really like consideration for youth to be able to buy an over-the-counter deer permit. It's kind of similar to what you're doing with the turkey. We need to get the youth out, and we're just not seeing the youth get involved in deer hunting early enough. And I think an over-the-counter deer permit available to youth would be a positive thing for youth participation in the deer hunt. Like I say, probably not the right time to make that recommendation or consideration, but I just want to keep that thought going.
Thank you.
There is a quota of, for each of the 30 units or 29 units we have now, a quota of archery buck deer tags available only to youth, and those never even come close to selling out.
And I understand that, but I think that youth archery and youth rifle are vastly different.
Absolutely.
Any other comments? Chris?
I'm with Justin that I believe that the cost of a youth turkey tag, $35, is a drop in the bucket. It's just a teeny tiny sum. And while I'm all for reducing fees to get people out in the field, I think that those 16 and 17-year-olds that are out in the field probably have a cell phone with them that costs a whole heck of a lot more than a $35 turkey tag, and they didn't buy it. Their parents paid for it. I'm just guessing, okay? And I would like to suggest to the outreach folks that if they want to get more people out into the field, they should plant a Pokemon gym in every turkey unit.
The Central Region RAC had the same suggestion. I still don't know how to pull that one off.
I'm telling you, you know, the outreach guys need to think this over. If you want to get more 16 and 17-year-old turkey hunters out into the field, you better start thinking like a 16 or 17-year-old turkey hunter. So $35 is just a teeny tiny sum, and I guess I am sort of suspicious that dropping the fee is going to have the effect that what we really want to have.
One comment, and with Kevin, it's probably not the right time to talk about it, but I'm with him on the deer stuff. I got a 15-year-old son who didn't draw a general season deer tag this year, and he's not going hunting because he doesn't have a tag, and I think that's terrible. But that's a comment that's not for this conversation. I do have a little bit of a question on the landowner tags that they're getting for free and charging these enormous rates for trespassing. In some areas, it's about the exact opposite. I won't say a name. In one place in my county, they get a whole grundle of tags, and they never even get offered to anybody in the public. They all be given to lands, and he's bringing people in from out of state. Another place is to shoot these landowner tags that are not even offered to the public, and they're the ones who are going to get the deals and not the public if they had the opportunity to hunt on those lands. So I don't think the reduction in $15, you're helping the landowners bring in out-of-state hunters to come shoot problem elk when they're not even being offered to residents of the county that they belong to. Thanks.
Anything else? Yeah.
I'm glad I came tonight because I didn't know that you could charge for those. I've been giving mine away for free. No, it's definitely a problem with depredation. My biggest issue is I have to be really careful who I give them to because of my landlord or whoever. I just don't want some Nimrod out there shooting a box and a half of shells to kill a cow elk or a doe deer, but I don't see that the cost is a lot. I get probably 25 or 50 of them every year for deer and for elk also, but I never give them all out because nobody wants them. Maybe somebody does that I don't want to have their shooting, but so I don't know if the price is an issue as much as all of the other mitigating circumstances that go with those. And I suppose there are people that sell them for a lot of money, but I just don't even give all mine away. So
I'm glad I'm sitting next to you.
Yeah. Well, buddy, you're proud of it. So I work with a lot of youth all the time, and a whole lot of those youth hunted turkeys last year. And I bet most of them were wearing $300 or $400 or $500 worth of camo. And they were shooting the $50 a box turkey loads. And they couldn't go to work because they had to go turkey hunting. So, I don't know, I guess it's a feel-good thing more than anything as far as I'm concerned. I just like to ding the non-residents more myself.
Any other comments and or a motion? Go ahead, Jess.
I propose we make a recommendation not to lower the price of turkey tags or the cow tag price and then accept all the other fee changes.
I second that motion.
Okay, so the turkey tag and
the landowner cow tag. They were going to increase it.
Okay, so the motion, if I
trying to compete against this project,
if I may rephrase that, is to approve the recommendations as presented. However, not to modify or adjust the turkey tags or the landowner cow tags. Keep those the same as they are currently. Okay, so we have a second as well for the motion. Any discussion on that? Seeing no discussion, I'll call for the question. All in favor, signify by raising your hand and saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? No opposed. It's unanimous. Motion passes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Phil. Okay, the last agenda item is a regional-specific presentation, and that will be on the WMA Habitat Management Plans by Pam Kramer.
Thanks for the opportunity to come before you this evening and talk, and you're probably wondering why you're here. So as part of what our state code is for our wildlife management area plans, state code says we have to bring our plans that after we write them for all of our different properties to the RACs as part of our process to be able to get your approval of what we want to do to manage those properties, and so that's why you're here. But this slide kind of lays out where we're at with the whole process that we have to go through. So state code says that we have to go through, when we develop the plan through our Northern Region office and get comments from our own people internally. We then go through the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources, our Habitat Council, to get their review, which has not only our state employees there, but also different stakeholders from the different sportsmen's organizations that are there to provide input as well. We then go to RDCC, which is the Resource Development Coordinating Committee, which is an entity that's housed in the governor's office. And when we put a project through there, it gets all the other state agencies can provide comments. So CITLA, SHPO, which is the State Historic Preservation Office, water quality, state parks, all the other entities can take a look at it and also provide comments to our planning effort. And then we go to our county commissions through that process as well to get their particular comments they may have on our properties that are within their jurisdictions. And then we come to you guys to get your approval and review of what we want to do. And then if the Wildlife Board chooses to hear our plans, they can do that as well. So it's kind of a long, involved process for the public to have involvement in what we want to do for management. And so that's why you guys are here tonight. So we're kind of at the end of this whole process. So with our management plans, it's kind of a long, detailed slide, but basically we want to write a plan that gives basically a one-stop shopping, tells us everything about the property that we need to know. And so if you've read the plans, you have an idea of what we have in those. And that would include everything from the background, why we purchased the property, how we purchased the property, water rights, grazing, mineral rights, what the vegetative conditions are like, what wildlife species are on the property. It's pretty all-encompassing with what's on the property. We look at access for sportsmen on the property. We look at what we might want to do in the future for habitat needs, for improvements, et cetera. So it's pretty detailed, and you can read the whole state code if you'd like, but this is just kind of a quick breakdown of what that is. So there are three plans I want to take before you this evening. Our East Canyon Wildlife Management Area, located in Morgan County with a little piece in Summit County. Our East Fork of the Little Bear River Wildlife Management Area, which is in Cache County. And then our Farmington Bay Waterfowl Management Area, which is in Salt Lake and Davis County. So what I'd like to do is do each plan separately and then ask for your questions, and we can address those. And I've got some other folks in the audience from the division that may help answer some questions depending upon how detailed you guys get for me. And then we'll kind of move on to the next plan after that. So the first one will be our East Canyon WMA. So for those of you that don't know where that's at, it's in Morgan County. It's the area in blue there, and it is just kind of downstream on East Canyon Creek from East Canyon Reservoir. So the property was purchased in the 1980s and contains a little over 3,300 acres of property, like I said, in both Summit and Morgan counties. And just for your information, the Kern River gas pipeline came through in 2010, and they, as mitigation for using our property in a variety of ways, they did purchase us an additional 160 acres of property to add to the WMA, so sportsmen have additional property they can hunt. We also have two walk-in access areas that are located adjacent to the property, one on the northeast and, or northwest, and one on the southeast. And that, for those of you who don't know, Morgan County is the most privately owned county in Utah, with 75% of the deer and 99% of our elk winter ranges are in private ownership. So which makes this small piece of public property pretty important to maintain from a sportsman's access perspective. The primary purpose for why we purchased the property was to preserve and protect the game winter range. We also provide the recreational opportunities which are compatible with that goal. And the primary recreation opportunities right now are upland game and big game hunting in the fall, and turkey hunting, and there is some shed antler gathering as well. And then you get horseback riding, hiking, and camping that goes on to a lesser extent. So at a glance, these are the capital facilities that we have on the property with several fences, two and a half to 3 miles of fences, several gates, as part of the Kern River mitigation for coming through our property and using our road as their as a staging area. They did build us a 30,000 square foot parking area down by the main road, which was really kind of nice for us to have. We have a number of signs. We have no water rights on the property. When we purchased the property, there was already two spring-fed ponds and a livestock trough that was developed, and we're in the process of trying to secure some water rights for that to make us more legal. But those, like I said, were already in existence. And the only structures is just a kiosk and some equestrian openings from the parking lot into the main part of the property. For those of you that haven't been there, this is just one glimpse of one of the ponds on the property. About midway up, to kind of give you an idea of the habitat that's there. And then we have two range trend studies that are located on the property. I don't know how familiar any of you are with the division's range trend program. So just real quickly for your information, in the 1950s and 60s, the Division of Wildlife Resources decided they wanted to understand better what our winter range conditions were for deer. And so they began a study or a range trend program to begin to assess the winter range habitat conditions. And that's morphed over time. And so back in 1996, they started, or maybe a little before that, but 1996 in the northern region, they started the program we have today. So it's been the same year after year after year. So we gather same data so you can compare year after year. Most other states in the West do not have this, and according to other folks in the agency, we're the envy of other states because we have such good data on our winter range areas. And the way the range trend program works is that every 5 years they move through all of the division's five different regions. So they were last here in 2011 and they're here now in 2016. And so we'll have that data later this winter to be able to assess what the range conditions have been for the last 5 years. And so we have one range trend program, or one range trend transect on the East Canyon WMA, and that's this first one, the Red Rock Canyon. And then we have another one in Tucson Hollow, which is just located off the property. And so this kind of gives us a glimpse, for the last several sets of years on what the habitat's looking like, what your grasses are doing, what your shrubs are doing. Are you having recruitment of young sagebrush, for example? It gives us a good picture of that. They also look at invasive weeds, they look at soil temperatures, they look at pellet counts for how many deer and elk are using a property, et cetera. If you look at the winter range condition where it says DC index under both of those, because most people don't know what this is, I decided to put in a slide that helps you understand that. So the DCI, the Desirable Components Index, was developed by the division to specifically for mule deer winter range. And we wanted to look at what makes good mule deer winter range. And so there's a variety of things they look at, from preferred browse species, the decadence of shrubs, how much young shrub recruitment is there, what's your cover of perennial, percent cover of perennial grasses. What about perennial forbs? We have a lot of noxious weeds. Is there a lot of cheatgrass? Is it going to burn up? They look at all those kinds of things to give each area a score. And so that's something, again, that we've developed that no other state has that I'm aware of to be able to help us better understand our winter ranges and be able to target those areas that need to have some habitat improvement, things done with that, and then assist us in determining what kind of projects would be best to do in that area. So this is our East Canyon, a closer view of the East Canyon WMA. So up here in the top, we have this isolated little blue parcel up here that public can't really access right now. We're looking at trying to rectify that. And then this is the northern green portion is the one walk-in access, and this is the other walk-in access. We're not proposing any changes from what we've been doing for years on the access for the WMA. There's the big parking area down here at the bottom. This is the 30,000 square foot parking area. Then there's an inner parking area right here, and then that's closed off, and so this is just all walk-in access all the way up the rest of the property. So right now we have the property, like a lot of our wildlife management areas in the northern part of the state, they're closed from January 1st to the second Saturday of April. That's to give the animals a place to be without having ATVs and people and dogs and everybody disturbing them. They can feed in peace and quiet. It also keeps animals on us, as opposed to if they get disturbed, they'll move on to adjacent properties and we'll have depredation issues on those areas. So we like to keep them on us as opposed to elsewhere. The wildlife management area is closed year-long to all motorized vehicles. There is the large parking lot, and there's a horse access gate along Highway 66. We have high public use of the property, especially by equestrian users. We also get your attendant vandalism and litter and, you know, target shooting that goes on, and some adjacent landowners are not real happy with some of that. And then we do have the walk-in access areas that are on the proper adjacent to the property. So nothing is changing from what we have been doing all along. This is a picture on the hill looking down where that inner gate was, the inner little parking area was I showed you, of what some of the area looks like during the fall hunting season. This will be your opening Saturday for your deer hunt season rifle. This is, as I talked about, the Kern River pipeline. This is coming through our property. So this is the north here. So this is coming from the east, comes through all the property, and then comes down our main road. So it's buried under the road. And then that large parking area is like right in through here is what they created for us. So, but they used our road for staging. Of course, they told us they wouldn't be there during the hunting season. And of course they were. And so they had to give us a different road and get some people in there at the time. So that's why they gave us the parking lot as good mitigation for that, as well as they bought us the 160 acres adjacent so sportsmen got a benefit out of that. So our habitat improvement activities we'd like to undertake on the property include weed spraying for some specific weeds of Dalmatian toadflax and some goat grass. We want to be able to use grazing as a management tool as needed to implement some, enhance some different habitat areas on the property. We'd like to install some fire breaks in some different areas. And we'd like to develop some additional management strategies to enhance the winter range in some areas. Additionally, the property has not been surveyed according to our new map with what we call species of greatest conservation need. We'd like to do that to find out if some of those species are now there. And if we do implement a grazing program, we need to do some rebuilding of some fences and pursue some additional water development opportunities, which we can only do if we get water rights for the property. And then maybe relocate that one range trend study to a place where we can maybe get some better data off of that. For property management, just typical stuff we do on all our properties, which is inspect, repair, replace fences and signs and gates, clean parking lots. People love to shoot up our division signs for some reason, so it's a constant battle to replace all of our signs. To map it, a lot of our noxious and invasive weeds. And then we're looking to complete that land trade to create a contiguous land block. So trade that isolated parcel that the public does not have access to with a landowner that has a parcel right next to the WMA, so we create one big block. So it's kind of quick and dirty, but are there any particular questions that anybody has that I might answer for you?
I had one. I just noticed on the graphs there when we were looking at a five-year study that it would be poor, poor, poor on as far as the winter range. Is when you get that type of news, was there an effort put forth to try to better it, or what? Did they do anything once? It was just saying we're in 15 years straight that it continued to be poor winter range. Has there been any kinds of different things, projects going on to try to increase, make those better?
Grasses are hard to get rid of depending upon the kind of grass that there is there. And so usually when the grass is there would be more of your annual, which we like more perennial grasses that have long-term benefit in terms of holding the soil in place. And there has been some planting efforts that have been done on the WMA, both seedlings and seed, you know, in the ground. It's pretty rocky and steep country, so it's really difficult to do, which is one reason we might look at using some kind of livestock like sheep to maybe get seed out there, and then use the sheep have tiny hooves that can drive the seed into the ground on some of the rockier stuff that we can't get planting bars into. You can't get equipment onto to even like a brush planter shrub planter to be able to get up there pulled by a tractor. So it makes it a little bit difficult there to be able to do something. And so that's where we rely on our biologists. Now, I work in the habitat section, which is different than all the other sections you've seen tonight. And so we take recommendations from our wildlife section, work with them to develop a project to go out there. And so to be able to see what we can do. But.
And money to fund any of those projects, is there, where would that come from?
So through the division's Habitat Council program, and also through what's called the Wetland or Watershed Restoration Initiative. And so through both of those, we would develop a proposal, we would put it through them and ask for comments on what we'd like to do, what we think would work, and then they would give us money. So when you buy your hunting tag or your fishing tag, that goes into a kitty of money. And then all the different regions, we're one of five, they all put in these project proposals, and it goes to this committee that then allocates all that money that goes out. Does that make sense? And so our project would get funded that way. And then through that process, you also had many other partners with the Forest Service and BLM and NRCS and Trout Unlimited. There's a ton of other organizations that help support
that. That was my question. As far as private money, could it be, has there been any type of effort to try to, we have different conservation groups in the area. I think Utah's done a phenomenal job of raising money. Mm-hmm. I'm just curious if it's who decides where the money goes and if some of these public walking areas where some money could be put there instead of just in our limited entry areas is a question that I had, is if that's a possibility or if there's a effort to try to put more money on these public open grounds like that.
They would prefer to put money on the public land for sportsmen to directly access as opposed to putting it on private
land.
When
I said public, I mean public, but I guess open areas like a WMA compared to a limited entry hunting area are different.
Right. So there's the two different organizations. There's the Division Habitat Council, which has four division people on it, our section chiefs, and then you have four outside entities. So, could have Trout Unlimited, you could have an upland game guy. Don Pay sat on it for a while. So there's different entities that are represented on there. They'll review all the proposals and make their recommendations as to what they think should be funded. And then that goes into a spot where it may or may not be funded, depending upon how many projects. Because everybody thinks their project's best, and they'll evaluate all those. Through the Watershed Restoration Initiative, you have all these different agencies that also develop projects, and that there's a committee that gets formed that selects those. They hear them, they'll decide if they want to fund them or not, and then they go into a kitty, and then that all goes with all the other regions down to Salt Lake, and they have another committee that will actually vote on who gets approval to get funded or not. So it's a competitive process, but there's a couple million dollars in the Watershed Restoration Initiative available every year that they can draw out of for that. And actually, Russ Lawrence used to sit on that, so he can answer that probably a little bit more specifically than I. Russ, did you want to add anything to that?
Well, I was just going to say that Watershed Restoration Initiative is a very complex funding picture, if you will. There's a lot of different funding sources that go into that. A lot of the money that comes into there is federal monies coming from the BLM, primarily, actually, right now. And a lot of that goes out on BLM lands. The state has always had trouble trying to get the money because Habitat Council doesn't have a lot to play with. And the legislature does put some money into the Watershed Restoration Initiative, but you know it's going out to do a lot of priority sage grouse habitat right now. You know, so it's each year there's some kind of thing that's driving it and so forth. This year it may be fire. So anyway, it's very complex. But for this WMA, Pam was right. It's a tough one because the slopes are steeper and it's hard to get equipment out on it. You have to be pretty creative in how you treat these kinds of places. I don't know if you had herbicide as an option as well, but you have to be careful with that as well because you might hit some other plants that you don't want to. So
if you have some specific thoughts as what you'd like to see done, you know what, we'd love to sit down and visit with you. So if you want to come see me afterwards, we can talk or give us a call or whatever, and we'll sit down with our biologists, and we're always looking for opportunities, to bounce around some good ideas and see what's going to work. We have guys that do this. That's what they do, you know, with the division, is they just look at developing projects, and they know what the best techniques are, the new and upcoming herbicides that, you know, will hurt this plant and not hurt that. They look at biological control issues that come up with different beetles and rusts and different things that are available, and so to get rid of some of the bad plants. And so does that help at all? Is that sort of? Not really? Yeah.
We'll talk after.
Okay. That'll work. Any other questions? Or
I have a couple.
I
know that grazing is a tool that's used to control the grasses on these WMAs in order to make the browse come. And I noticed that you've got grazing there. Is this a every year bid on thing, or is it a multiple year? In other words, if somebody puts in a bid to graze that, are they allowed multiple years or 1 year, or how does that work?
Are you looking for the grazing program in general or this specific property?
For this specific.
So on this specific property, we basically have an agreement with the adjacent landowner to graze it because the whole property is not fenced. And so unless somebody herded their animals, we wouldn't be able to keep them contained within the property boundaries. So we're just grazing with them at this point in time. But there is the way the process works is that they, by grazing on us, they get a benefit, or they give the public a benefit. So they might put in fences, or they might develop like water troughs, or they might spray weeds, or there's different things they can do. So, or they pay us money, either way. So either in kind payment or monetary payment on that. And for this one in particular, I think it's just we just do it with them for right now because we don't have fences all the way around the northern part of the property. And for other properties, it'll go. Their division has a grazing bid process, and I can get you that if you want to take a look at it. What it is by code.
I understand. I just wondered how this one. Is.
Yeah. So, but it's like up to 1 to 3 years, you know, of being able to graze it, you know, and there's a whole process we go through to bid it. So,
my other question or comment was I know we're way over objective on elk in this unit. Could that be a reason for the downturn in the transect?
I don't think
condition.
So, because it's been going on for a while, but I would defer to Randy, our wildlife program manager, if he wants to answer that, or Darren, if he has any specific thoughts on it. But
Randy, what again? Probably not. They went in there, as you know, you're pretty close to that property, and it'd be depending on the snow depth and how far down and where they hang. So I would say that it's not directly related to that. However, we are trying to bring that down.
Right. I know the drought has had the drought conditions we've had over the last several years have had a big impact on trend studies, but I was just wondering if by chance that.
And the trend crew is actually in our region this year, and we should know this spring in a little bit how everything looks.
Better hurry before it burns out.
Is there any more comments?
Thank you.
What's the water acquisition problem?
That area of Morgan County is a closed basin, so it's not open for any new appropriations of water. So we'd have to find somebody who was selling water for us to be able to buy it and then move it to the property. So we're sort of stuck.
You can't even make it work, huh?
So there's and that's just the state of Utah water right laws the way they are. When I asked our guys in Salt Lake, well, you know, do we have a water right for this? And they're like, well, no. And I said, well, there's water there, and it's developed, you know, and that's what it was developed illegally before we bought the property, but it's still there. It still provides wildlife benefit and livestock benefit as well. So
Craig and then Mike.
Yeah, I had a question. Are there any sage grouse on that property?
No, there's sage grouse that's to the east of it, closer to East Canyon Reservoir, but we're just off the edge of it. So it'd be nice if we could to buy the property to the east and get some sage grouse habitat, but there's none on there. I mean, they might fly over it, but there's no lex on it. They don't use it. It's a little higher elevation than that. So,
Mike,
Pam, I was curious. Is there a plan in place? if these water shares became available, is there something that you could do immediately to purchase those shares so that you wouldn't lose them and lose that opportunity?
We have a water rights specialist in our Salt Lake office, and he's aware of that, and so he just kind of always looks for it, you know, looks for water.
Want to make sure there was something in place so that if they did become available, we could act on that.
So. Yeah. So.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any more questions or probably comments from the public on this? If not, comments or motions on this particular management plan?
So we need to make a motion to.
If you approve it now, or you can prove them all at the end. I don't know, Justin, which was. I don't know that it matters. You know, I guess you could do them now, do them separately.
Let's just do them. Yeah, do them individually. So, a motion on this one.
I would move that we approve this wildlife management plan as unit plan as presented.
Okay, motion by John.
Second.
I'll second. Second by Kevin. Any comments on the motion? If not, we'll vote. Everybody in favor, raise your hand and say aye.
Aye. Aye.
It's unanimous. On to the next one.
Okay. So our next one is our East Fork of the Little Bear River Wildlife Management Area that's in Cache County. And this one, for those of you who haven't been there, we're about a half a mile downstream of Porcupine Reservoir, which is outside of the town of Avon, in the southern part of Cache County. And so this was purchased in 1991, and it contains about 240 acres of land. We purchased it primarily for the East Fork of the Little Bear River that flows through it, so it's primarily a fisheries-oriented property. And we also participated in the construction of Porcupine Reservoir at one point in time. So there is about 1,000 acre-feet of dead storage in Porcupine Reservoir, and then 500 acre-feet of active storage that we can use either in the reservoir or to send water downstream to help the fish through the part of the property that we purchased, like I said, about a half mile downstream. So we have our choice of what we want to do with that. So for those of you that haven't been on the property, this is I'm looking to the west, looking down towards Avon. So the East Fork of Little Bear, these are willows here, so the East Fork of Little Bear is just over in this area. And there's a hillside, you'll see another picture later, a hillside coming down, and these are some of the trees that kind of line the bottom of the hillside. And this is just a road that runs, that now has the Ruby Pipeline, now runs underneath of that road. But that kind of orients a little bit of what the habitat looks like. So primarily when we purchased it, like I mentioned, we did it for angler access and then also to protect terrestrial and wildlife or aquatic wildlife species that might occur on the property. And then the recreational opportunity is primarily angling. There's not a whole lot of deer and elk that use the property, so it's not an active big game hunting area. There are some upland game species that are there, but it's not a real high area for that. It's mostly an angling property. So we purchased it in 1991. So so this is an aerial photo of what it looked like in 1993. So for those of you that have been there before, this is La Plata Road coming down through here, and half the property is in through here, and the other half goes upstream. And Porcupine Reservoir is like way over here. So this is our main parking area is right here where the La Plata Road crosses the East Fork of Little Bear. So our main parking area is right there. And then that's that road that I just took the picture of earlier, looking to the west. So if you notice, the stream is very straightened. It doesn't meander a whole lot. And what happened in the early 90s is, actually in the 80s, there was some, Cache County did some flood control work and kind of went through and sort of straightened the channel. And so there wasn't a whole lot of fish use of that property, nor angler use of the property. And so we wanted to do some restoration. So in 1996, we proposed a project. Then there was just the Habitat Council. There wasn't a watershed restoration initiative back then to return the stream to a good channel. And this was the first that I'm aware of in the state of Utah where we took a large area of property and decided to return the stream to a natural pattern. There's the stream construction or reconstruction rehabilitation was sort of in its infancy back then, and so we had some people that wanted to try their hand at it, and so they wanted to do this project. So we increased the stream length from 2,200 to like 3,300 feet. We slowed water velocity, raised the stream channel. We had riparian forest vegetation was transplanted to the stream banks from other areas. We put it in a heavily grazing prescriptive pattern to be able to manage the upland areas so we didn't lose soil there. So we did a whole bunch of things that were there. One of the cool things is that they left part the part of the old channel there as backwaters to provide nursery habitat, refugia areas for some of the your young of the year fish. And beavers have moved in, and it's just kind of cool. So this is what it looks like now, and I'll show you a chart in a minute. But so this is what it looks like now. So where we are walking, so this is the road that kind of flooded, but this is the old channel here. The old channel that kind of went through here, so really straight, and then these are all the meanders we added. And yeah, they look kind of fake because we made them. God didn't make them. We made them, so they're kind of engineered, as it were. But you can see all the additional meanders that we put in through there to kind of add habitat complexity, add riffle pool areas, some different run areas that the river just didn't have before because it had been straightened. And so this is kind of at a glance what we did. So before restoration, which was pre-1996, and then afterwards. So we went from 2,200 linear feet to 3,300, 60% stable banks to 95 to 100% stable banks. From one meander to about four and about a half. Nursery areas, we added four, increased our brown trout per mile, and then all fish, adult fish biomass also increased. We went up to a little over, at least in 2014, over 15 beaver dams were found in the area. We've increased our angling pressure on the area as well. And we've increased the width of the riparian area along each side as well to make it stable. So we've done quite a bit. It's pretty cool. They haven't gone out since 2005 to do a fish survey, but I'd like to see them go out again and do it now and see how much more we've increased it. So just another picture of the property. Again, kind of looking west, we can see the hillside coming down. There's not a whole lot of shrub component of that to support any like big game deer winter range. This is some of the tree habitat that's there on the edge. Again, this is the cottonwood tree. So the river is like right over through here, and this is just a kind of a grassland area that's on the edge of the river. For our access for the property, again, this is the whole property. We have the main parking area is here, the large one. And again, because Ruby Pipeline used our pipelines, love to use state property for their staging of their activities. But because they used us again, they made us a really nice parking lot again and graveled it and put in some new fencing, and we got a bunch of stuff out of it as well. But so this is the large parking lot here. There's some additional parking lots along the road, and then just some assorted pullouts. Vehicles can just pull out of off La Plata Road or East Canyon or the Canyon Road here. There's a buck and pole fence that runs all the way along this side of the between the road and the river, and then as it moves over on this side, there's another fence that kind of follows all the way along here to keep people from driving into the river itself. But there, people camp there; they have campfires there. There's walk-in access; they can either through the buck and pole fence they can get access to it. So right now we're not looking to change any of the access on the property. It's open year-long to public use, but there's no motorized vehicles that are allowed on the dirt road on the north side of the river. There's the one large parking area, and then there's several pedestrian walk-through areas. So we're not planning to change anything. Our capital facilities at a glance for the property is that we had about a mile of buck and pole fencing along the main road. We have some barbed wire fencing. The entire certain on the western boundary and parts of different boundaries, but the whole property is not fenced. The road that's there is an administrative access road. We have three water rights for stock watering on the river and the streams that run through the property. There's no water developments, and there's a kiosk, so it's pretty low maintenance. There's not much kind of going on with that. Just for your information, again, for the pipelines that come through us. So this is Limekiln Canyon that comes down. They came down this canyon, coming up from the hardware kind of plateau area or the Ant Flat plateau area, came down this area, turned. They have a mainline valve here, and then they went down that road I was showing you through the middle of the property and then off of us. I must say they did a fairly good job of working with us. From a timing perspective and minimizing their impact on the land, they could have been a lot worse than they were. We didn't want them to come through us at all, but for having to come through us, they did a fairly good job of dealing with our concerns and issues and working with our anglers. So we do have one adjacent landowner who claims to have an unwritten and unrecorded access interest to their property through our property. However, they can't produce any agreements and we can't find any agreements. And so under Utah law, that any party claiming a non-possessory interest in the property of another carries the burden of proof of establishing that claim. We're still working with these landowners to try to get something resolved to give them some access to their property through a different means than coming through the state property. So pretty quick and dirty again. Are there any particular questions?
Any questions from the public? Questions from Marat? Chris?
Pam, what is that interest, that the non-possessory interest, what do they want to? They want to drive through the property? They want to move livestock through the property?
They want to drive through the property every year to get to their own property and bring their campers and their trailers and their family members and ride four-wheelers and do a number of different things on us. And we would prefer to not have that happen, and so we're looking, because that's no other motorized vehicles can drive on that for the public. And so, as well as it destroys the ambiance if you're angling there and your vehicles are riding up and down the road, it kind of takes away from your enjoyment of the property. So we're working with another landowner to find them a different access into their own property so that we can keep our property, you know, for the benefit of the public. So
there's no more questions, comments from the public? Comments or motions from the RAC?
I'll make a motion that we approve the plan as presented.
Okay. Motion's been made and seconded to approve the plan as presented. Comments on the motion? If not, vote. All in favor, say aye and raise your hand.
Aye.
Aye.
It's unanimous.
All right.
Next one.
So our last one for tonight is our Farmington Bay Waterfowl Management Area, located on the shores of the Great Salt Lake in Davis County. For those of you that haven't been there, this is just kind of an overall view of what the property looks like. This is Farmington in this area. Glover's Lane is at our north boundary. And then you have Centerville is down in this lower area through here. And so we just kind of border all this property through here. We have some land that's fee title, and we'll go over that in a second, and some land that's we manage via state code. So in the spring of 1935, the National Park Service and our predecessors, the Utah Fish and Game Department, got with the Civilian Conservation Corps and decided to purchase about 3,800 acres of private land on the shore of the Great Salt Lake to try to create some good avian habitat. And so the current acres, we went from that to our current acres, it was 18,400 acres, of which we own 2,400 acres. We manage the other 15,900 acres via state code, which gives the division the authority to manage lands that extend out into the Great Salt Lake that are actually sovereign lands. So we have lands there at Farmington Bay. Ogden Bay is the same way. So is Howard Slough and Harold Crane. We can manage. There's certain lands within the Great Salt Lake we can manage. Usually it's what our tailwater from our impoundments, what it influences, what we can actively manage out in there. And there's the manager now of Farmington Bay is here. If you have some particular questions, he can answer. We've also had some lands that have come to us through land donations, some wetland mitigation projects we've worked with the Corps of Engineers on, where projects get done where they fill wetlands elsewhere, they buy and create wetlands adjacent to Farmington Bay, and then we pick those up and manage those for wildlife. And then there's also some conservation easements that we also have on some lands within our boundaries that we help manage for wildlife. So federal aid or Pittman-Robinson dollars were used to only purchase 120 acres of the property, which is really a low amount considering some of our properties are 100% purchased with federal dollars. So the primary purposes of when we acquired Farmington Bay was to preserve, protect, and restore and enhance aquatic and terrestrial habitat for wildlife. We want to provide hunting opportunities for the recreationists and whatever they want to do out there, from bird watching to hunting to trapping. We also look at trying to recover and protect some of the sensitive species that occur out there, and basically provide some public education, which is a new thing that's come about with the nature center that's out there. So this is just an aerial view of the property. For you haven't been out there, so where the pointer is over here, this would be Glover's Lane out here. This is our main entrance road coming down here. This is our main headquarters area. The office and restroom and equipment yard, et cetera, that's all out here. This is a pond that we actually have a conservation easement on that's owned by Pacific Corps. We have a conservation easement where we manage it for wildlife. This is under their power line that runs through the area. And then this is more of the property here, and you can see how close we are to Centerville, well, Farmington, and then Centerville down here. So they kind of all roll through that area. So we're fairly close to the to urban development. So our management of the property is to maintain infrastructure and equipment. Our managers and assistant managers manage the property to provide a diverse mosaic of wetland habitat types. They do aggressive phragmites control, and for phragmites, there's two kinds of phragmites. One's native, one's non-native, and it's a non-native one that's giving us a lot of grief because it takes over certain areas. And so they use a combination of cattle grazing, herbicide treatment, some burning, and other water management techniques to be able to try to get rid of that. And there's a whole crew. In fact, they're starting next week? Week after next, they're starting there. So if you guys, that's what Justin was mentioning earlier. If you guys want to get out and help spray phragmites, they'll take you to come out and help with that. So it's an interesting experience to try to get rid of it. And when you see how much of our impoundments and waterfowl management areas it has taken over, it's pretty scary that there's not a whole lot of habitat for ducks out there in some areas, or food for them. They also do some upland habitat improvements for planting some nesting cover, food benefits, for upland game birds, as well as a lot of your waterfowl species. They control other noxious weeds, both aquatic and upland. There's always carp control, because we love to have carp. And they do annual wildlife surveys. And just to give you an idea, because most people don't know what these guys do out there, there are 12 different kinds of wildlife surveys that they do, and there's probably more, but there's 12 that I've got listed on these two slides. They do their monthly waterfowl population censuses. They do quarterly upland and shorebird censuses. They do breeding pair duck and goose surveys, duck and goose brood surveys, duck and goose banding. They also participate with university researchers in our Great Salt Lake Ecosystem Program on shorebird, wading bird, and rail surveys and other cooperative efforts that go on. They do sandhill crane and tundra swan classification surveys. They do colony bird counts for like white-faced ibis and herons. They have a midwinter waterfowl survey. They do waterfowl and shorebird nesting surveys. They do bald eagle counts. They do the bag checks for waterfowl hunters during the waterfowl season. And they track all of their kind of animal control efforts, because we have issues with predators, and so we have trappers that come on the property as well. So that's quite a lot to do besides managing the water in your impoundments, you know, to manage for wildlife or your bird habitat. So at a glance, this gives you an idea of what's out there. So we have 5 entrances, 7 miles of fences, 12 parking lots. The one that gets me is the roads and dikes, or 47 miles of roads and dikes. That's a lot to manage out there, to make sure they're graveled, the muskrats aren't making holes in your dikes and your tire falls through. And it's just a lot to work on to keep things kind of going. Your areas have to be dredged to allow your water to go through. They have 225 water control structures. There's about 450 acres of waterfowl rest areas. Give the birds a place away from hunters at times. Different gate openings, bridge openings. There's 8 boat launches. There's 20 miles of ditches and canals. For buildings and structures, we have an office, an ADA accessible restroom. We have that large outdoor equipment yard I showed you earlier. We now have the Robert N. Hostinger Nature Center that's on the property. It has 2 small education buildings and a deck surrounding that and some restrooms there. And then we also have some trails that are associated with the Nature Center. And I think Marnie's here, and she's hopefully the new lead on the Nature Center, so she can answer some questions on that. So there's quite a bit of infrastructure that's got to be maintained besides managing the habitat itself. So the main habitat concerns on the property are phragmites invasion, like I mentioned earlier. And so we do aerial spraying and some ground spraying, grazing and water management. There are some nutrients that come into the Farmington Bay from the Jordan River. Everybody flushes toilets and storm drains run off, and it all kind of comes to the Great Salt Lake. We're at the lower end of the watershed. And we do have a lot of algal blooms. So far we don't have anything like what they have in Utah Lake. It's a whole different kind of algae that we have. We do have some predator issues we take care of, and then there's always development that's trying to move closer to us and either take out wetlands or become close enough that it affects your hunter experience out there when you have a lot of houses near you. So this is just a quick glance at what the access is on the property with some of the parking areas and the boat launches and the dikes and stuff that are open for use. We're not asking to change anything with this plan right now. We're planning to keep everything the way we've just been managing it for years. This is another view of one of our impoundments. I believe this is the Turpin unit, which is kind of more towards the southern part of the Farmington Bay area. And so the access right now is that the property is closed from March 1 to August 1 while our birds are nesting on the property. There is year-round vehicle access is available from that north entrance where the headquarters was down to Goose Egg Island. And Goose Egg Island is an island that was created back in the 80s when we had all the flooding and Farmington Canyon was flooding and all the sediment just was rushing down the canyon. And so when the city or the county, and Justin would probably remember who it was, had to do something with all these truckloads of dirt. And so they took it out and we thought we would use it to maintain our dikes, but they put it all in one area and they made this overlook area. So if you ever get a chance to get out there, it's kind of fun to drive up on top of that and get a good view of Farmington Bay. So anyway, the roads are open down to there all the time. The outer gates for the interior parking areas open in mid-September and close at the end of February, so they're open during the waterfowl and the goose seasons. And vehicle travel is restricted to the gravel roads and parking areas. We do have airboats are allowed, but they're restricted to the Great Salt Lake shoreline. They're west and north of the diked impoundments. There is an airboat launch that's available at the north entrance. There are small motorized boats may be used in the channels and diked impoundments, or people want to take the little John boats and stuff in there. We have two rest areas, again, which are the 450 acres, one that's located near the headquarters area and one near the new education area facility. And there are a couple vaulted toilets and some hunting blinds as well on the property. So the Nature Center is new for us, and it's the way the mission statement has been is to foster curiosity, understanding, and pride in the Great Salt Lake ecosystem among Utahns and the global community through a world-class education and recreational opportunities. So right now we have about 5,000 elementary school children visit the property, and there are also some college classes and the general tourists also visit the property. This is located on land that was purchased by URMCC, which stands for the Utah Reclamation, Mitigation, and Conservation Commission. And they were that it was donated to Farmington Bay for this wildlife and education purposes. The current mobile learning center used to be near where the headquarters was, and it was built in 2003 by a Davis County school, I forget which school, built it for us. And then it was moved to the current site, which is further to the west of the headquarters area in 2007. And the Utah legislature has funded a new nature center, an actual building for us to have, which should be open within the next few years. So it should be kind of nice. So our public uses of the Farmington Bay, we have the duck hunt opening weekend. We have an average of 1,500 to 2,200 hunters that are there. For Bald Eagle Day, we have an average of 1,400 visitors. We have the Great Salt Lake Bird Festival, which does a behind-the-scenes tour of the property. We get about 5 to 10 bus tours that come through on that. For the youth waterfowl hunt, which opens a couple weeks before the opening of the general season duck hunt, we have about 300 hunters on average that come. And then in general, we have about 100,000 visitors per year, with about 20% of those being hunter use days per year. So we have a lot of other photographers and joggers and bird watchers and just all kinds of people come out and use the property. So any questions? That's a lot of information with all three of those plans.
Questions from the public? Questions from the rack. Okay.
Well, I'd like to make a comment and a question. My comment is I think wildlife management areas are great, and there's a lot of them in the state, and I think the state needs to be involved, and I guess that's my question. How involved is the division in working with, like, conservation groups for conservation easements and acquiring property and stuff like this so we even have more? I just think they're, we should have people, when we have opportunities to get more of them, we should purchase them or do things to even get more and take care of the ones we have. And I just would like you to address that. It's not tied to this particular project, but just wildlife management areas in general.
We are always looking for opportunities to protect additional lands. for our wildlife. We usually look at lands that are adjacent to our existing lands or other protected lands, because if you build on what you have, then you can increase the value for wildlife. So instead of having a small postage stamp area that's protected, you've got a larger area. And so around Farmington Bay, the previous manager, one of which was Justin and Rich Hansen, they were very creative in working with, like I said, the couple conservation easements with UDOT and with Pacific Corps. They've also worked with URMCC to get the property, you know, a couple hundred acres that they donated to us. We've worked with the Corps of Engineers on some mitigation opportunities. We can get those. That's with UTA and with UDOT. So they've gotten pretty creative on what they can do with that. And so we'd like to purchase some additional lands around us to buffer us. Even more than we are now. You know, we had Legacy Highway that came in next to us, which kind of destroys some of the ambiance on that east side of the property. With the new West Davis Highway, we're not sure where that's going to go yet, but that may affect part of us as well coming in. So we'd like to kind of buffer as much as we can so we don't get houses moving in on this particular property. In a larger sense than all of our other properties, we still try to do that same thing. We've identified some different properties in different areas we'd like to see protected. Again, you know, if you have to have some kind of a vision for the next 50 years, what do we want wildlife habitat to look like in the next 50 years? Because we know if we don't do anything, we're going to get worse than what we have now with development moving in. And so there's plenty of robin habitat with people's front yards, but there's not always a lot of good, you know, deer winter range habitat. And so we just kind of try to actively work to pursue those opportunities. And I don't know if you guys have anything else you'd like to say on that, but most of us are pretty active in looking for opportunities. We'll get officers or other biologists will call us and say, hey, you know, so-and-so said they may be interested in selling their property, and we'll look at that. The Utah State Legislature doesn't want us to own more property. They want more private land ownership. But they think down south, where we have lots of public land down south with all the BLM and Forest Service and National Park lands, up here we have much more private lands. And if you look at Morgan County, you know, with 99% of our elk winter range is private, that's a problem. You know, what do you do at some point in time with that? And so it makes it difficult to work. And so we try to work. Again, I'm with the habitat section. We try to work with the wildlife section and the aquatic section to see what we can do. Our walk-in access program has been pretty successful with trying to get public access to lands, again, surrounding us to provide some additional sportsman opportunities. We do work with other private landowners on habitat improvements as well, because there you have some private land that supports our public wildlife, but you want to help the habitat where it's at, where they're at, because then they'll come down and be hunting opportunities on our state property. So we look for all different kinds of options on that. But if you know of anything in particular, I'd love to talk with you too on what's available. So, but thank you for your comment.
Any other comments or motions?
I got a comment.
Oh, sorry.
So Pam, I just want to thank you for being here tonight. I know it takes a lot of work to put one of these plans together, and you know, I haven't worked, you know, at a desk next to you for 12 and a half years, but it looks like you're continuing to do these things, and I don't know anybody that has put more effort into these management plans and more time and dedication and care than you have. And so I just wanted to let you know that I'm appreciative of the work that you do and that you care so much about it, because it's a lot of work.
Thanks.
And also, I know it can be hard to get all the biologists together and get their, you know, get their input. I was one of those as well, and I left a couple of plans in your lap when I left too. So, sorry about that.
That's okay. We forgive you. You're doing good stuff now, so we forgive you. So, thanks though.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Any other comments or motions?
I make a motion to accept the plan of the Farmington Bay WMA, mm-hmm, as presented.
Okay. Motion made by Justin, second by Craig. Any discussion on the motion? If not, all in favor, raise your hand, say aye.
Aye.
Unanimous. Thank you, Pam, for your presentation.
Thanks.
Very informative. Now I'd like to make a motion to adjourn.
I'll make a motion to adjourn.
John, second. Matt, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. unanimous. See you guys next time.